Hey everyone, thanks for checking out this week's episode. I just wanted to let you know that the Ember.js community survey is still going on, so if you haven't filled that out, head over to emberjs.com. There's a banner to click on right at the top, or you can find a link to it in our show notes. Be sure to fill that out if you're an Ember developer and share it with your team. Thanks, and now onto the show. Is module unification a thing anymore?
The last thing I heard is that it was, this was actually one of my questions for you, but that template, you know, like the use helper that's been talked about, and like the way templates, I guess it's like template scope,
right?
What's the term you use there?
Resolve, like resolve, how they resolve the component lookup stuff,
right? So that is in flux, and module unification can't be decided on. By the way, I'm stating this as if I know it, but this is really a question.
Yeah, I think. Yeah, module unification as a concept has changed so much that I'm not sure it actually means is meaningful right now, or it's, at least it's not meaningful in the sense that it's not a shared concept anymore. It means different things. Tom recently opened an RFC that was talking about some of the template import stuff that they've been working on. And that's exactly what you said, which is like when a template sees curly drop-down menu, what does that mean? And there's been a lot of work to make that stuff more explicit as opposed to right now, which is like, it could mean a lot of things. The at sign means it's an argument. This dot means it refers to a local property or local lookup, but there's still a question about like component resolution. In Vue, there's a components property on components that registers things that are available to the template context. So if you want to render a UI button, you would import it in your Vue component, add it to the components property, and then you can use UI button in your template.
So basically the way they resolve is they use JavaScript's import module system, but then expose all those things they've imported in JavaScript as like local properties on the component, and the template just looks up there.
Exactly. So there's a mapping. Whereas in React, everything is, since it's all one file, then there is a, you're within the scope of where you import things. So the way you use a button is just to import it and use it. There's no mapping. There's nothing that needs to, there's no translation step from what is in being referenced within a template. And then how does that resolve? It just resolves the same way if you import a variable and used it in console.log.
Yeah. The React, first of all, JSX being compiling down to JavaScript is pretty nice.
Right.
And that lets them piggyback off the JavaScript imports, which, you know, over the last year or two have worked out pretty damn well.
Yeah. There's never a time I can remember working in JavaScript where I was like bothered by ES6 imports. They're great.
Yep.
So I think there's been a lot of talk about what that looks like in Ember and how we can improve the story. And the most recent development was, some sort of import in the template layer. I think the RFC Tom just opened up talks about how to do this in a lower level way so that add-ons and projects can experiment with different ways of doing it. And I think they cited the benefits of the lexical scoping of the JSX solution in React, but still wanting some of the benefits from having like separate templates and how to thread that needle, how to get the best of both worlds, basically. And because they don't want to commit on a solution right now, there's some lower level stuff that's going to come and let people experiment. But I hope that in the future there's one way to do it, because I wouldn't want there to be one of the best parts about right now in Ember. There's basically two ways to do it. There's a classic setup, which is what's in the guides and what's like the Hello World example. And then there's pods, which was like half released, but it was basically released. It was just not as polished as they would have liked, but it was so useful that lots of people use it, including me. But if you go into an Ember app, it's either going to be classic or pod style. Pods resembles more of the module unification approach, but in either case, you are pretty much right at home. You know where things are. If you look at a template, you know how to find what it refers to for the most part, with the exception of edge cases, which is what a lot of this is about fixing. So I wouldn't want to see a new low-level thing that makes it so that there's a diaspora and like a explosion of new styles of app layouts, because I think the stuff that they were recommending with like the module unification previews is really good. It matches pods in almost every way. You have your UI tree layer, which is as a tree, and then you have the stuff that sits outside your UI layer, like your data layer and your services separate. So all that stuff makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, even with pods, you know, when you just turn on pods, everything is a pod by default. But we only use pods for, it's like routes, controllers, components, but right. Things like models and services, we look at those as global, so we don't use a pod disk layout file structure for that stuff.
Right, right.
So, yeah, I don't know, like Ember's pretty good at like community conventions, even though there's a few things that there's like two ways to do actions and two ways to do file system layout. I think this is one of those things that, yeah, there'll probably be a bunch of experiments, but then, you know, I would look towards like leadership and say, what do y'all do with your, right. which template are you using?
Right. And hopefully one of those makes it back into like the guides basically.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it would.
I think it will too.
So
I'm eager for it because I want to start using angle bracket components, but I haven't yet because we use lots of nested components and there's no great way to use those yet. Once there's a way to link the style of component in the template with its resolved value, either through a component property or lexical scope, then it'll be great.
You don't want to use a let helper?
Do not want to use a let helper.
You don't want like five indented let helpers for each year?
No, I refuse. Our friend Dave Wasmer made a add-on that lets you basically do the use thing. So you can just like use it's or import. It might be like curly import button from, and then you get to do a path. And then you can just use button at the top level.
Oh, super cool.
It's really cool. It's also just like it's just his project. And I think the upgrade step to whatever ends up being decided upon will probably be pretty simple. But it's also like, yeah, it's just a new project. And I'm sure there's edge cases and bugs and stuff like that. But it does look, it's very tempting. I've been very tempted to like just take all EmberMaps code base, install that, and go angle brackets on everything. But there's also like some interesting conversation where like I've been working on the Ember Animated repo a little bit because we're doing some training on it and I just want to start using it in Ember Maps front end. Even though you can use angle brackets for anything, Ed made a really interesting point, which is basically like there's something really nice about curlies for control flow. So like and variables, right? And you still use curlies for those. But if you're looking at a template, it's nice to see angle brackets for components, but then like curly if. So then you have components from Ember Animated, which are like, is this a control flow thing or is it a component? And so, you know, animated if is a component, but it's really about control flow. And there's other things like that too. I think there's going to be some still figuring out there. But I think you can end up with something that it looks really nice.
Yeah. Yeah,
where absolutely. Like the curlies jump out as like splitting things up into logical groups, but then the components are about like declaring what's rendered.
I would say just like if I can point at the screen and say that's this component,
right.
I would want to see angles.
Right.
But if I can't, curlies.
Right. Maybe it's like that. What was that judge ruling on pornography? It's like you can't define it, but you know it when you see it. Yeah. It's like a button, you know, it should be angle brackets. If should be curlies. The stuff in the middle, I don't know, but maybe you just know it when you see it.
Maybe you can open up an RFC and then you can have a section called like prior work and reference that.
Yeah, prior art.
Yeah, prior art. Yeah.
How you and your team can decide whether to use angle brackets or curlies. Well, there was this interesting court case a couple of years ago. Silence. So what you've been working on, you've been doing some more app development recently.
Yeah. Yep. I've been doing app development for the past few weeks. It's actually, it's pretty good. It's like really good to get, you know, back into working on a big Ember code base.
Consistently kind of day in, day out, you learn things you wouldn't.
Yeah.
By just parachuting in or whatever.
Yeah. I have like some, like a very small API change I want to make to storefront. Just, hey, I've run into this thing like three times about like background reloading data and whatever. That's not what I want to discuss about this. But yeah, I just want to bring up that it's good to work on an Ember app. I'm on this kick lately where I think that SPAs should do everything that a server rendered app should do. And
more.
But if they can meet that minimum of what a server rendered app can do, you're in a really good spot for your SPA.
Since you have an architecture that will kind of progress with you as you have more complex UI requirements.
Right, right. And some of these things are like, some of these things are, could be super hard. Some of them are just like, hey, how am I going to load data? So an example of one that's like kind of easy, shout out to Ember's router here, is that Ember's router lets you load all the data before any of the templates rendered. So you can put like a promise in the router and it won't render anything until that promise resolves, fulfills. And this is like, this is kind of how I think of a server rendered app, right? Like my backend's going to fetch all the data and then hydrate that that template and then send it over the wire. So I'm never like partially rendering a template on a server rendered app, and Ember's router lets me like take that concept and apply it to the UI. So,
and then when you need to break up the loading of the page, you can opt into the more complex path where you split it up.
Yes. So that's a great example of like, and more.
Right.
Right. So yeah. So what I'm noticing now is I want to like come up with like some rules. The way I would phrase this is like tasteful, like data reloading. So here's the thing I ran into last week is you're looking at a list of cities and you go to edit one of those cities and it like pops up a modal that overlays that list, and you can, there's a bunch of data. It's a Ember data model.
A city is.
You edit that city, you click save. Now, what would happen in an Ember application is like that city that you're editing would update, but none of the other cities would update. Right, you're only saving, you're only calling like model.save on the city that you're editing.
Mm-hmm.
So you would see your city update, but if like your coworker also updated another city, like let's say you were updating New York and your coworker was updating San Francisco, you would see New York update, but you wouldn't see like the new data for San Francisco get pulled in. Now in a server rendered web app, you would, right? Because you would submit the form for New York, then the server would re-render the whole list of cities, and now you would see all the edits that were made in San Francisco in the meantime since like you initially loaded that page.
Right. You wouldn't if they made a change after you loaded the page. But well, if they did make a change in, but whatever changes were made since the last action, you would see.
Yes. And I think my point here is like when you take an action in a server rendered app web app and then get like a re-render, you're looking at the freshest data.
You're looking at the canonical data from the server.
Yeah, exactly.
As of the point in time that you made the action.
So in my Ember app, I've been trying to emulate this sort of stuff. So now when I save that city, I do I update that city and then I do a background reload of all the cities. So the cities, like there's like, I think this is pretty nice. Like I don't show a loading spinner on like the list of cities when I'm refreshing it. It's just a regular background reload. If someone had happened to edit a city or add a new city, that thing would show up. But this is something that I had to like, I had to think about.
Yeah.
I had to add this in, and sort of like the test for adding this in is like, okay, what would happen? When would the person see new data had they been using a server rendered app?
Right.
And that's what I'm using as like a guiding, you know, how to guide these sort of features or API requests or reloads, whatever you call them.
I think that's really interesting. It's interesting to think about how do you replicate the server architecture, and then how do you and more it, right? The server architecture in this case is every time there is a user initiated action, we're going to give you the latest canonical data. That's like a sign that we need to basically re-render everything you're looking at with the latest snapshot of data from the server. And it just so happens that that's built into the architecture, because the only way you get a new page is by clicking a link or submitting a form. So that's a great baseline. People are familiar with that. If they're clicking around an app and things change, like they understand that, even people who aren't technical, lay people who use the internet, also, you know, non-tech people who use the internet, if they're on a page and you were to say, oh, like refresh the page, most people would understand what that means. Most people would understand that when they clicked that link and got a render, it was as of that time. And if something changed, they're probably not going to see it without hitting refresh. So the server architecture is basically if you take an action, then you see the latest data. And that is where a lot of the confusion comes in on the front end, because there's tons of situations where you take an action and you aren't looking at the latest data anymore. Now, there's a flip side to this, which is the stuff that's hard to do on the server architecture, which is you don't take an action, but you need to see the latest data. So if you have Slack open and there's a new message, you haven't taken an action yet, but you better see that message. Yep. Or you better see that there's a channel notification or something like that. And that's hard to do in the traditional server architecture, because how would you do that? Basically, like, it goes outside of that happy path architecture. But I think your point is really interesting to me, which is that at a minimum, if you're doing a user action, you should be seeing the freshest data. And how can we build that into the happy path hello world example and then tell you, hey, look, you've got this working. You've recreated your server architecture, but now you need to refresh that channel list whenever there's a new message, even if the user doesn't take an action. Here's how you do it. Yes. And that's like such a better story in some ways, because you're barring off a shared knowledge about how servers work, and you're going to avoid a lot of bugs that we've seen folks run into when you just take the caching first approach.
Yeah, exactly. And the way I'm doing this now is I'm just like, when I'm writing my tasks or my action, I'm thinking about what the server would do. Mm-hmm. But I'd love some way to say, to not, I'm doing like model.yield model.save, yield route.refresh.
Right. What you want is for Ember or your application to be aware of the data that's currently presented on the page. And anytime you basically interact with Ember data, you call .save, you call .save or destroy record or whatever. Anything that actually goes to the server, it knows what the current query is for every piece of data on the page, and it reloads it in the background, let's say. That would be one easy way you could do that.
Yep. Yep. Now that seems like really advanced to build up to that, but like maybe there's some tooling, some patterns
I think you could do it in a simple way, which is basically Ember could assume all the data you need for the render is like in the route, and it would just call like model.refresh or reload anytime you make a change to your Ember data store. That would be one way to do it. We've talked before about if you are peppering refresh reload true all over your app, you know, that's an issue. Not necessarily, that's an issue with like the framework. Like you're falling into a pit of, you know, not a pit of success in the sense that like Ember is not holding your hand enough here. We have it in our own apps. I'm just saying that's a sign that there's something wrong with the architecture.
It's so true. I went through that this morning where I probably have the latest data, but I just need to double check it. I'm like, I'm adding a join record to a user, and there's certain rules if this record can exist. I probably have the latest data. I know the route loaded the data, but like before I save this, I'm just going to reload it because I want to make sure that when I entered that route and then, you know, time passes, I want to make sure that like a coworker didn't modify that data.
Right.
So I just pepper a bunch of reload trues there and fetch it all. And yeah, there's, my mental model there is I'm thinking like, what would the SQL query be if I were writing a backend app? Right before I go to save the user, I would just check. I'd use my ORM to check, like, can I make this join record?
Mm-hmm.
And if I can, okay, I'd save it and return the response. And that's sort of where that comes from, where like all those reloads come from.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting, yeah.
You know, Rails does have reload methods on their models in the ORM layer, because even though you're working in kind of this synchronous flow of like request, logic, generate response, and then return with the response, and you don't have like long-lived stateful applications the way we do in Ember, even in that middle step, there's opportunities for the data you're working with as a programmer to get stale, right?
Yep.
Now, we see this, the Rails work that I do, I know just enough Rails to be dangerous. Fortunately, like nice. The tools are there such that like you don't really have to know. I know Ruby, I know Rails, but you know, I can make a production Rails API, but like I don't have those like years of just doing like Ruby metaprogramming that folks did who were deep in like Rails app development. So the most time I've used reload in the Rails side has been like testing, let's say. My question for you is, can you remember a time when you're doing business app development, business logic, and you need to reload a thing, reload a model like in a controller, where like you've done some work and it was like complex enough that somehow your data that you did, maybe you had, we're dealing with an expensive getter, like, and you initialize some model or it does something, and then you need to like do some validation logic and persist stuff over here, and before you return it, you need to basically reload a model after some changes have happened.
So when you were telling that story, that my first thought was tests are when I use that, and you hit that. You know, I can't remember a time I used controller. I had that, but the situation you're describing, I'm sure if you looked at all my Ruby code, you could find, you know, a handful, two or three times where, yeah, you've got some complex data structure. You modify one side of it, and the other side needs to reload because it has
it's stale.
It has many that's stale, and a new record got added. You know, generally, in the Rails ORM, I think is really, really good, and if you like stay within its guidelines, you get so much for free. So I think outside of outside of the testing, if you find yourself calling reload a lot, it might be an indicator that
you're not understanding something.
Yeah, or it might just be like, hey, you've got a complex a really complex data structure here.
But for most apps, you're not doing that.
It's not like, this week I'm calling reload here.
Whereas you couldn't really say that for Ember.
Right.
You can't really look at an Ember app that's like a production Ember app, see reload true, and say like you're not understanding something.
Absolutely. But the life cycle of an Ember app is days to weeks, where the life cycle of a Rails app is 30 to 50 milliseconds.
Right. They got an easier go.
Yeah.
But still, it's about abstracting those details from the programmer. And so when you're building a Rails app, you don't have to think about stale data and reload true as much. You do have to think about it. And if you start making more complicated applications, like even like GitHub and Stack Overflow, that are more static in nature, and even like document oriented in nature, they still have all sorts of features for like showing you the latest comment, if you haven't taken an action on your own, or like showing you that the post has been updated if you haven't taken an action on your own. So basically, anytime you have a situation where you need to update the data without being prompted by the client action, then you're in this same situation.
Yeah. And this is where you love, this is one of the spots where you love being in an SPA.
Yeah, right? Totally.
It's just totally like, okay, this is where the fun part starts.
It's so true. I mean, again, it reminds me of that real-time map I built, you know, at our last job, and just how once you're rendering from the local client-side cache, how the data gets in that cache and how often it reloads is a separate question.
Yeah.
So there's a nice boundary there. But I really like that, thinking about that, like, especially for a beginner to fall into a pit of success, but not even a beginner, even intermediate and expert developers, to not end up with situations where you have a user looking at some table and it's like, why is this not updated? I just changed this or whatever. There's room for Ember to help there.
You know, I think I really do think like the router pushing you towards loading data first and then rendering.
Yeah.
That's such like, I think that's such a huge thing, and I think it's really easy to dismiss that. You could say like, oh, you could build this in React. You just make a loading component, and that doesn't render its children until its data is loaded. But there's nothing that's guiding you towards that. And the fact that Ember's router just pushes you towards that it's like super, super, super undervalued.
You can't. I totally agree. I don't think you can state how important the nudging is, and just the hooks that they give you. You know, a tool like React is very flexible and low level, and everything is just a component. But because of that, it's like what you said, you don't have the guidance. I was just working on getting Mirage working for React and Vue apps, because that's something we're experimenting with. And I've never done like React app development or Vue app development, but you know, I consider myself an experienced programmer at this point, and I can learn things pretty quick. I was very surprised to find, you know, Mirage is all about data loading, persistence. I was surprised that in the React website, if you search for like fetch data, you find like one little comment on the API docs of one thing. It's basically not existent. So then you start Googling like, how do I fetch data in a React app? course, on the one hand, someone could have like a snarky response, like, well, how would you do that in any JavaScript application? Like, whatever you're doing in Ember, you can do in React because everything's just a component. You can import jQuery and use $.getJSON. You can use Axios to make an AJAX request. You can use fetch. But it's all the stuff you just talked about. So it's like, how do I fetch data and then render it to the screen in a way that makes sense, you know, when I'm navigating between routes in the lifecycle of a single application or initial page reload? I happen to like find you use component did mount or component did update to do it. But there's no guidance there. The Vue side, actually Vue has a router and they have a document saying, do you want to fetch data before you render or after? And they have a way to do that. So that's really
nice.
Cool.
Nice.
It still took some digging to get there. The main Vue website doesn't really talk about this. This is like on Vue CLI. If you're using like the official packages, which is like an option, whereas in Ember, like everyone uses the Ember router, right? Yeah. So I think that's the kind of thing where you're talking about getting people to replicate the bread and butter behavior of a web app, like bread and butter. Like you can't make an SPA without persistence data, which means we need to talk somewhere in our documentation about fetching data and persisting data. And there should be some way to do it that replicates the server behavior, but then lets you do the and more stuff as well.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was pretty surprising to me. But again, I think it's a double-edged sword. And I think to really nail it best, you want what Ember has, but you also want to be able to drop down to the extra stuff. And like we've seen this with Ember, like one of the ways that Ember fails this litmus test is like, let's say you want to move the data fetching from like being a blocking fetch to doing it lazily. You know, we have a pretty good pattern for that. You move the part of the query out of the router's model hook, and you put it in a data loading component using Ember concurrency. But there's still some issues there. Like, yeah, there's still a few things there. That's a really solid pattern. It'd be great if that was blessed, because you could imagine if that was integrated into the framework, it would be even smoother. There could be an even smoother transition path there.
Yeah, definitely. And just some of like the roadblocks you hit with that, it's like, okay, do I do it in like did insert element? Do I do it in init?
Right.
Do I do it in did receive adders? Could my component remain rendered, but its inputs change such that it needs to refetch data? And just figuring out those things.
If you want to display the state of the task on the controller's template, it's like not easy to do that. Yeah, you could imagine if it was part of Ember, like you would just take the... some people have done this before where you, instead of returning a promise and model that blocks, you return like a task or you return an object that has, you know, is stateful and yeah. has like lets you say if it's loading or not, but it's clunky.
Yep.
But the way we do it, that's basically like we understand how we would do that. So that's great. But then there's all this other stuff like what you're saying that's not handled well and that teams do differently. So yeah, that's a really cool like mental model. I like that. Let's do what the backend frameworks do first before trying to overreach, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Lets you focus and lets you make sure that there's a smooth path there. I think Ember is in a uniquely good spot to do this because there is so much stuff about data fetching in Ember's guides. If you make an Ember app, like you're going to be doing data fetching stuff. Like, you know what I'm saying? That is an Ember app. It's like has Ember data. You're going to be thinking about where I'm getting data from, all that stuff. So I think it's in a really good position to like say, hey, you have some data on a page and it could have changed. You know, in a server app, this would always be refreshed. But because we're building Ember apps, like, you know, you have a cache of data. This makes things fast, but let's make sure to also not get things stale. Here's how you do it, blah, blah, blah.
Yep. Yep.
So.
Yeah, I think Ember is in a great, great spot for this sort of stuff. So I'm excited. I'm excited to keep pushing this idea and I'll keep you updated on what sort of things I find with trying to build a server-like app.
So basically you're just going to kind of, as you add new features where the current user from your app's perspective mutates data, you basically reload the data that's being presented right now.
Yeah.
Something like that.
So the furthest I've gotten is there's like a route hook called like refresh. So I'm refreshing the route, which reloads a model, which renders, you know, gives new data to all those components on the page.
Right. Unless you happen to move some of the data loading outside of the route.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And so then this is where you want that story where it's like, Ember has a first class way to not block on the render, but still have the system know what the data dependencies are of the currently rendered route.
Yeah. And this is too low level, but I feel like I need to get kind of dirty to experiment here. But
right.
We use storefront returns like a Ember data query object,
mm-hmm.
which you can call dot reload on,
mm.
and that'll update everywhere that query object is used.
Interesting.
So yeah, we can do stuff like that.
That's pretty cool. You know, you could have, if you execute or create all of your storefront queries from a component instead of by writing JavaScript in like a hook somewhere, you now have did insert and will destroy. So on did insert, your query data fetching component creates a new query and executes it, and it also sets it aside. And so you could actually just look at all of the currently run queries, and on will destroy, it removes it from some service.
Ah, I see. So you have like a global registry of queries.
Nice. Exactly. And so you could actually just look at that registry at any time and see what queries are driving the current page.
Yeah.
And then you could just, you could have like a hook anytime I come back from like the adapter, or like anytime I go through like model.save or model.destroy, background reload all the queries in the registry.
Yeah.
Pretty interesting.
My mind's going immediately towards like someone's going to have a form open and I'm just going to start reloading stuff.
Yeah.
The other thing too,
you can mark it as like live or something.
Yeah. Reloadable. Yep. Another thing too is like with the data loading component, you could yield out a reload this query action.
Right.
And then you could, we always write Python these components. Yeah. We always write these components that are like, has a component and that has like a did save and that takes an action. And when the component's done saving, it fires that action. So we could do like did save, take whatever was yielded out from the data loading component and refresh that, pass that action to, as our did save.
Yep.
So, I think there's a
pretty interesting.
Yeah.
It would be interesting to hook into storefront and say, whenever anyone calls this, here's how you can like register this query and here's how you can unregister it. That way, like even on deactivate, a hook of a router, you could say unregister the current routes query, and then on will destroy for a data loading component, you can unregister it. And that way, in that like did save hook, you can just say reload all registered queries or whatever, like just call a service action. This also reminds me, like, we basically already do this in fastboot because we have cache keys for each page that we fastboot, and so it doesn't matter if those come from a model hook of a router or a task on a data fetching task on a component, but we end up with a cache key that's a key value pair of everything, all the data dependencies for that current fastboot page.
Yeah. So anytime our fastboot app makes a network request, we can basically get a really high level view of what's all the data that's used on this page. And we hook into, basically hook into the URL that is being built from JSON API's point of view.
Right.
And we can say, okay, we know that this page has posts because you made a request to / posts.
Right.
And we know that that's returning a post resource.
Right. It's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Because why do we do that? We do that to bust the cache when a thing has changed. So we're already talking about stale data.
Yeah.
We already do this.
Yeah. Yeah. So using that
same pattern,
Right now, I wouldn't even mind something that's like low level. Like even if I had to inject a service and put actual queries into it, I'd be okay with that. I know we can build up higher level.
No, I think the registering things in a registry is pretty low level, pretty easy. I mean, you just something like that. You need to get a hold of it. But you just made me think like. So. That's like the heavy-handed way to do it. Let's say your parent route has a model hook, your child route has a model hook, and you have a data loading component over here, right? So you have like three different queries. Those end up in a registry somewhere. Then you go to edit this country, you hit save, and then there's like an after save that's like registry reload all queries. So just as a background reload, like the user doesn't actually know. The user is getting a sync render of everything that's in the cache. But if something changes, like they just see it. So that's nice because like they're looking at the freshest data eventually. Like it's eventually consistent after a background reload.
Right. I just want to say the background reload is nice here because
super nice.
Usually the data doesn't change.
Right. So, exactly.
So it's not like I'm like, hey, let me reshow a loading spinner and all this stuff.
Totally. Background Reload is really great for situations where you have like a list of things and like it's just every so often 1% of it changes, but like you still want to see the cache value or whatever. So that's like the heavy-handed way to do it. But what if you basically took the approach we do with our fastboot cache, which is we pull up that cache key and that lets us selectively reload things. So what you could do...
I know where you're going.
You don't even have to background reload unless, you know, post colon 3 has changed. You now know this page depends on post colon 1, post 2, post 3, comments 1, and comments 2. You create comment 3, you hit save, but you can tell the back end, I'm subscribed to post 1 through 3 and comments 1, 2, and now 3. And have any of those changed since the last time I requested them, you can just let me know.
You know, last week we were talking about refreshing an Ember app when you deploy a new version.
Yeah.
This is like the same idea. It's like refreshing
the model in a store when there's a new version of it.
Yeah.
When it's changed.
And we built all this stuff for fastboot, so we could totally piggyback off that and say like, I mean, even
ideally it's like a WebSocket.
That's exactly
what I was going to say. And you just push the newest snapshot of post colon one into the store or whatever.
You know, a lot of like this Ember app I'm working on now, it's like a backend tool to use by admins.
Mm-hmm.
So they have access to all the data.
Mm-hmm.
So I could just use a Rails WebSocket and just pump over I could have like an after commit callback in the Rails model and just pump that
over. Pump a message out, and if anyone subscribed to it, like post one has changed or whatever.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's pretty interesting. You know, you get into some tricky territory because like you don't want just post one, like maybe the query was like post one include comments. And so you wouldn't want to override the snapshot of the post one in the store if it didn't have the links to like the comments, because you might break the relationship. So I think you want to start at the query level. Basically, if I had a query, get/post/one include comments, I want to be able to say when the last time I ran that query is and has that query changed.
Yep.
So it's like you're subscribing to a query instead of just a model.
Yep.
Yes. As a start, you can imagine getting to the point where you're at the level of a model of a resource.
By the way, that I started this conversation with, I just want my app to behave like a server rendered app. So I'm going to reload a table whenever you edit one of those items in what, like within 15 minutes.
We're talking about subscribing to real time queries.
So I just want to.
I mean, that was like,
this is why JavaScript apps are hard.
Yeah, seriously. That's why. That was like the Meteor. What's the RethinkDB where you like subscribe to a query? That was the idea, right?
Yep.
Like you could do like select star from users where age greater than 32, and like you could tell if that query changed.
Yep.
Yeah.
And I think I've been playing with GraphQL. I think Apollo has the watch, subscribe and watch, subscribe.
A subscription, like GraphQL subscription.
Yeah. And you still have to build implement the backend part of it. Yeah. But yes.
But there's an interface there on the front end. Yeah. It's pretty cool.
And there's backend libraries to do that.
So I mean, that's really cool. That's really cool. Should we try to get VC funding to build this? I basically want to like write an Ember app and like on the index page, do like store.findAllPosts include comments and just boom. Like you're looking at an app, the initial render has a loading screen, renders it. And then, like, if anything changes, you just see. It's basically the Firebase case. It's really close to Firebase.
I think we've talked about this. I think you need an API that's there's ways that we can describe our data, like Twitter.com, which is show me all the tweets as of right now. And then if there's more than 5 tweets that are new, don't show them, but pop up a little banner that says, hey, there's 5 new tweets.
I think it's 2 separate queries there. I think you have a query that's like, give me the latest 20 tweets as of 2:07 p.m. That's not going to change. So I can still subscribe to it because it's not going to change.
Yep.
Right? Unless you like delete a tweet or something, but then you'd want to hide it anyways from the UI. So let's say, give me the latest 20 tweets as of 2:07 p.m. Each over them, boom. And then you have a second query that you execute after render that says, give me the latest 20 tweets. And you can just subscribe to that. You can even just get the ID of the latest tweet and compare it with the ID in the 20 list. And once that thing is like, there's like 5 records between those, you can show the new UI. And then what you do is you change the query again. But if you're thinking about the real time description of like, if I had a direct connection to the database, what do I want to show? That's basically what it is.
Is it two queries? Is that an implementation detail, or is that something that the web app developer needs to know?
If you're talking to the product person, that's how you would talk about it like that, right? You wouldn't just say, show me the latest 20 tweets. The developer would say to the product person, okay, well, what if those change? Like once they're halfway through reading the first one, like, oh, okay, actually the business requirement here is show me the latest 20 tweets as of when they open the app.
And then if
and there's then anything once new. There's five new tweets, show a button. Those are two different queries.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the best way to handle that case. Cause we talked a lot about this and maybe it's nice to think about being constrained by a single type of query, which is like a live bound query to your backend. And if you can describe your entire UI using those, then like, you don't have to have like a live version or like a flush or a buffer.
So I prototyped this.
Yeah.
And that's why I had one query, and that query had a dot live, which linked to a whole new Ember data store that was like live data. And you could say like query dot live dot new records, query dot live dot removed records.
Right.
But maybe that's too magical. It's right. Not the constraint is nice.
Right. Now, right.
Two queries. Yeah.
Two queries is interesting, but then you get in this problem where you're like, you have this, and maybe the right way to think about it, just kind of talking through this out loud, is like always thinking about it. The live thing makes you think about it in the context of what you have on the server. So, if you did a query that was like latest 20 tweets as of 2:07 PM, you would want to keep it that way. Like you wouldn't want to then peak all because like, you need other queries elsewhere that might be pushing more tweets into the store. Yep. So that thing needs to actually be representative of that thing. But, you know, and we've talked about this before, like unifying the language, the query language across HTTP, as well as like what is derived from your local cache. And you need a unified language there, ideally, for all this to work. But if you had that, you could do it with two queries. So it's pretty interesting.
That does, yeah.
I think that passes the
server rendered test too, yeah. That I'm thinking of.
Mm. If you were to fast boot all this or whatever.
Yeah, or just like the underlying table that the user is viewing is always up to date because that could be a live query. So yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. That's all I got on the server rendered
stuff. That was good. That was a good conversation. I get excited about this data stuff because I think it's the most underserved. It's like the middle class stuff that we talked about. It's like underserved areas of SBA development.
Yes. And I'm learning that what people think of the data stuff, the realm is so much larger. So when we think of data in Ember, we think of like Ember data, API, and backend. But I think it extends further than that. I think it's like if I'm working with a model, I need an easy way to validate that model.
Mm-hmm.
I need an easy way to do like pessimistic updates and optimistic updates. And so like mm-hmm. very quickly your data layer mm-hmm. just starts consuming. I need like a way to do forms.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, there's great form add-ons out there. But all of a sudden like the data layer just gets a little larger and it consumes half my app.
Yeah.
And I think it's really it's massive service area.
Yeah, totally. Interesting. I'm really interested to see where this stuff's going to end up. Like, I wish I could just see 5 years into the future. I think it's going to take 5 years. I think it's going to take, like, I guess I'm trying to think what I would actually bet on this.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to ask you. What's the bet and what do you want?
Like, components and declarative rendering, once we understood that, that's what all the frameworks look like. So that was a shift in a paradigm shift.
Yeah, like inner HTML went away.
Exactly.
So what is the thing that goes away with this data loading stuff that we're talking about? Is it like I never call fetch?
That's a pretty good question. It's not about fetch versus $.getJSON versus Axios or whatever, because Ember data has abstracted that from us. So we don't call GetJSON. I don't know the peculiarities of $.ajax, whatever. That's not the point, though. The transport format, the staleness of it, that's something, right? Maybe it's like not having to think about my data being stale in the happy path case. Like, of course, you can lose internet and then you have stale data and you have to think about that. And app developers will always have to think about that because that's a business concern for the app.
Maybe it's I can express all my data concerns in a template. Maybe that could be like...
Or, yeah, right, right.
Because then I get like a declarative.
Yeah. Yeah.
I have a question.
That's pretty interesting, though. Now, would you have been able to say, like... so, like, Angular came out with components, and then, like, Ember was like, dang, those were, like, pretty awesome. Like, components is maybe all we need. We don't need, like, views and all this other stuff. React came out. They're all components. And then Vue came out. It's all components. By that time, Ember was all components. And it's like, components are what we need. And so it's like... we should just be able to declare our interface and like inner HTML is like not the right way to do it. But like, would you before have been able to say like in the backbone days when you're writing your render method and you're like setting inner HTML, would you have been able to say inner HTML is the thing that needs to go?
Yeah, that's a great question. And you could write a backbone app without ever using inner HTML.
Yeah, you could append and stuff.
You did, though.
You could like, be super smart. You could try to be super smart and append, but that was one of the things that React helped show everyone, which is like thinking about how things change over time is like super hard. It's way better to just say rendering is a pure functional state.
Yes, yes.
So maybe that's the lesson. It's like rendering is a pure functional state, and the tooling, whether you're using React, Vue, or Ember, or Angular, is all the mental models are the same. Declare your state. Render from that state, and then the tooling can take care of state changes over time. So maybe that's the principles that we're looking for now, which is like you have this problem where if you're like basically doing imperative data fetching, then you have all these problems, which is like the data can become stale and like it can become inconsistent, which is in some ways like the same as the rendering stuff. Like your UI can be inconsistent with like your state. So, you know, maybe it's something like that. I'm having this like vague memory of Pete Hunt talking about this like a year after React came out publicly, where he was like, everyone thought we were crazy when we said we have a virtual DOM and we re-render every time everything changes. What if I told you we do the same thing with databases? I'm trying to remember what he was talking about. I don't know what he was working on at the time, but that'd be interesting to look up. But yeah, maybe it's the same thing where it's like, we're going to, in 5 years, in 10 years, we're going to look back and say like, yeah, just ever thinking that a developer, an app developer ever thinking like right now I need to select star from users. That's a huge mistake because as soon as you do, you're done, which is like the same analog to like, if you ever say like div.innerHTML equals hello, comma, Sam, you're done because now you're responsible for how this thing changes over time. Your tooling can't do it. So like there might be a future like that.
Okay, so maybe the change is we need a database or backends or whatever, push data out. Like all queries are derived from the database. They're not query executed at a point in time.
Right.
And if you want to execute a query at a point in time, there's ways. Maybe there's some API that lets you do that.
And it has to be like declarative in the same for the same reason that you go from inner HTML to like declaring like hello curly first name. That's huge. Like, so you basically need to be able to say the same thing like each latest 20 tweets as of 2:07 p.m. and that's it. You know.
Mm-hmm. I was talking earlier about how there's so much where this data stuff expands and there's validations and forms and stuff like that, but it's even goes the other way as well. It's your database, your backend.
Yep.
So.
Yep. Interesting.
Yeah, I wonder what it will look like if there's some layer that can unify all this.
So the RethinkDB, it shut down? The guy stopped working on it?
I think so. I think there's an...
Because I think their argument was basically like everyone's thinking about databases wrong and you need to start from subscriptions. It was something like that.
Yeah. I don't... Yeah. Yeah. I think it might be open source or there's a few projects like this.
But even what we're talking about is slightly different because it's more about the expressive language on top. It could be implemented with anything, I think. I mean, it could be a pain to implement it with traditional database tools. But what I'm really talking about is like a higher level idea.
Yes.
In the same way, like the virtual DOM could be implemented in, or like Handlebars rendering engine could be implemented in like any sort number of ways. But it's more about what's the abstraction you're using on top. So I do think... Yeah, I think there'll be a time where, and like GraphQL, like queries and mutations are in some sense higher level than just like running a query as a point in time. They're like describing a query. They're like describing the data you need. And so you could imagine tooling layers doing more to like keep those up to date and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. So I do think 5 years, 10 years, like there's going to be a paradigm shift in the same way there was for declarative rendering for the data fetching stuff.
Sign me up.
I was working on Dependabot stuff last week because I made a video talking about Dependabot, which is this really cool tool that lets add-on authors or library authors automatically update their dependencies. And it kind of opens the door for some interesting workflows where this tool not only can open a PR saying some dependency is out of date in your library or your app, it can automatically merge it if your test pass. This led to like an interesting philosophical conversation where you're kind of presented with the question of, if my test pass in this new version of a dependency, am I safe to merge? It's like,
sorry, like, I thought your philosophical question was like, is it okay to force OSS maintenance onto these machines?
Oh, robots?
Yeah. Yeah. But that was like ethically okay. Okay. Anyway, continue.
Am I ushering the robot revolution by shoveling off this menial work to these machines? There was a new Boston Dynamics video about, and they're just like poking it with a broom.
Don't do that.
And it was like a bipedal machine too. It was like standing up.
Oh, and it could react
and
to it?
And it was pushing it in the chest and stuff. And all the comments were, of course, like, this is the beginning of the end. So the philosophical question is like, I have a thing, you submit a change that happens to change a dependency. Like, can I merge it if my test pass? So this, there's a lot here, right? First, do you trust your test suite to flex all of its behavior such that any PR that passes is mergeable in terms of preserving? If you're just talking about preserving external public APIs.
Yeah. I think like just my initial response to that would be like, yes, it's okay to merge it, because if I did like yarn update interactive and I bumped a dependency that could be at
higher level, if someone just submits a PR to storefront, it's not about dependencies. It's just anything. They could change some code somewhere, like anything, like in our test pass. Would you be okay?
It depends on the project, but yes, if someone opens a PR and
it's a refactoring.
It depends on the size of the PR and the project. But like if someone did a very small PR to storefront,
yeah, what if I
you're going to get me to say no, but
what if I add a thing that says after you run this function in 5 minutes, throw an error, your tests are going to pass.
Yes.
So you're not going to merge that code though.
Okay. Okay. So
set timeout, throw poop.
Okay. So yeah, I would need to see the code.
You would need to see the code.
Right, yes. Because you could say, I changed 5 lines and the tests are green.
Yeah.
Will you merge this?
Yeah. And you would say no.
Yeah.
So the question is, do you trust your test suite?
I hate you so much. I mean, yes, I do. But I guess that I don't blindly trust it. Do you trust your test suite? There's like baggage associated with that term. Mm-hmm. Like I know the change that's happening. I'm familiar with the test suite.
Damn, this is a good conversation. Maybe we should save it for next week. I think basically the conclusion I came to is what you said, which is like, you trust it, but you don't blindly trust it. Tobias mentioned this phrase Reagan said, which was from like one of the Russian leaders at the time, Gorbachev or something. It was like, trust but verify, which is kind of funny, right?
Yeah.
Is it like does that mean you trust me or not? Like, if you're verifying my work, do you trust me?
I think it means like you give people the benefit of the doubt and you trust them, but you also like, it's your response. You can't just blame them if they mess up. Like, it's your responsibility to verify that.
So you don't really trust it. It's just kind of Reagan in the video clip is like, I like the phrase, you know, there is something almost like, gray area about it, but it does kind of match up. Like, I was even thinking about like our work, like, you know, I post a video and you look at it and say like, oh, you did something here. Or like you post a tweet and I look at it and say like, it's not that we don't trust each other, but we're still going to like throw an eye at it because we know people can make mistakes, right?
Yeah.
Tools can make mistakes. things can, mistakes can be made. So,
and the feedback is super valuable.
Right. But it's just this interesting question, because when you talk about a tool that automatically merges updates, that's where it comes in. Because if you say automatically merge any update that's green, you are saying you blindly trust it.
Yeah. Interesting. We should, can we table this?
Yeah, we'll table it, because there's more to it than that. So yeah, that's a good one to look forward to.
Nice.
Awesome. If you want show notes, you can go to
embermap.com/podcast.
What is this? Episode 55 or something
this
like that?
This is 54.
54?
Yeah.
It's pretty good. 54 episodes.
Yeah.
You didn't want to do a podcast at the beginning. Remember?
No,
I had to twist your arm for like 6 months to do it.
It's the greatest. It really is.
It's fun. It's a lot of fun. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you in episode 55 next week.
See you.
Bye.